Hi, everybody. I'm Tony. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to talk about Annie first. Yeah. I remember the first time we met, and I bet she doesn't, but the reason I remember was because she sounded just like me. And she was one of my sponsees, first sponsee. And when Heather introduced me as her sponsor, Annie just looked at me and just went off. That she said, she says that I need to go to a meeting every day, and I have a job, and I have to. And she was just going on and on. And I remember just standing there smiling because she just sounded like me. And she says, "How long do I have to do that?" I said, "Till she tells you to stop." And I don't know if she was gonna, you know, since I was Heather's sponsor, she was gonna try me because I used to do that. You know, let's see what this person says, and you know. But if I would have said to you that day. You just keep coming, honey, and in a couple years, you're going to have a wonderful new life. You're going to be engaged to a great guy and get a beautiful smile on your face and a sparkle in your eye, and you're going to be calling me to speak at your home group. You would have said, whatever, wacko. I didn't say any of that. I just, you know, but I remember thinking, gosh, she sounds just like me in 91. My very first sponsor, that's what I said to her. Well, you losers may have time to go to a meeting every day, but I have a life. And my sobriety date is April 8th, 2004, so you don't have to have a math degree to figure out that it took me a while. And my first reaction, because of, you know, life keeps happening, even after we get sober, is I wanted to say no. And I've never said no, because I believe it is an honor to be asked to speak at an AA meeting. And I was taught that early on, that you don't say no, and it's an honor. But because of all the things going on in my life, and, you know, I didn't want to, because I might cry or something. So I put Kleenex in my pocket, and if I cry, y'all have to get over it. But it is an honor to be asked to speak, and I'm thank you, Annie. And every time I see you, I think about the first time I met you, and I'm just so, just get filled with gratitude, and when that's what it's about, because here we both are, and I didn't say no, mainly because my friend Dick gave me this look that made me scared he'd break up with me if I said no. But seriously, no, you know, I thought about it for a minute. I thought, I've never said no, and I'm not going to do it now, because no matter what is going on in my life, there's nothing happening that a drink or anything else isn't going to make 1,000 times worse. And I was messing with John, his figure, outside, because he called me ma'am. So this thing about, I'm still, sometimes I forget that I'm 48 years old. I don't mind saying that, but I feel really old when I remember that. Because it was like, I heard somebody say one time, it was like I went to a party when I was 14 and didn't come back till I was 31. You know, so I started drinking at a really early age. I was like maybe 11 or 12, and I know I drank alone and I blacked out. Red flag right there. But like John was talking about, I found out many years later that, you know, I always had that feeling that we all talk about, like I didn't belong anywhere. I never fit in, no matter where I went. No matter how many times I was, you know, I was really smart in school and I didn't even try. You know, God blessed me with a brain, and no matter how many times somebody would tell me, "You're so smart, you're so pretty," it didn't matter what anybody said. I felt worthless. And I always had this empty, you know, that just empty feeling, and just, I didn't belong anywhere. And I had one of those crazy dysfunctional families that everybody talks about. I mean, liquor was just like, it was on the grocery list. We had a bar room, you know, we had a pool table, and we had parties, like, you know, practically every night that started off fun and always ended up with somebody bleeding or an emergency room visit or, you know, police coming or, you know, and this was a really long time ago. We weren't quite like they are now, but, you know, I had a childhood that no child should have. And, you know, you hear that a lot here. And I drank and I did other things, and this is an AA meeting, but the other things are a big part of my life, and I have to say that if it weren't for the other things, I may not have gotten where I was so quickly. Because after years of, you know, I went underground for a while. Like, as a teenager, I was out of hand. I quit school, and, you know, I drank and drugged. Almost on a daily basis from the beginning. you know, I quit school, and but then I like went underground. You know, I grew up in Pittsburgh, and you know, what everybody does there is, you know, the guys work in a steel mill, and the girls get married to a guy that works in a steel mill. And you get pregnant, and not necessarily in that order. But then that's what I did. You know, and once I had my first son, I went underground. You know, I never really stopped because I could never handle life. You know, I didn't like me at all. I never learned how to cope. You know, I had no coping skills at all. And I went to nursing school, and I graduated with honors, and I became a registered nurse, and I found out about morphine and some other things, but you know, cut it. Diverting pharmaceuticals, that's the pretty way to put it. But I never lost my nursing license, but they did send me to rehab. And I remember the first time I walked into that rehab, you know, and they start that keep coming back, and even my husband said to me, why are they telling you to keep coming back? I don't know. You know, I thought I was only supposed to do this once, and you know, you pay $30,000 and you're cured. And that was pretty much the opinion of my whole family too. You know, once you do this for 30 days, I mean, you're cured, you shouldn't, you know. You come out and I did the same thing you did. I had 30 days off work, and you know, then I had to go back to work, and I did not have time for this crap. And when I was in the rehab, my first AA meeting was like 5 or 6 guys, like older than God, came in single file, and the one guy started talking with the day of his birth, in like 1901 or something. And he was, you know, almost, and I remember that I kept falling asleep, and I'd wake up and say, what year is he on? Say 58, I'd go back to sleep. And that's what I thought AA was. And even I started to, because everybody else was so concerned, I'm going to just say it, heroin. As soon as they heard heroin, it was like, forget about everything else. That was the problem. And, you know, everybody was like that. And the lady said, have you ever been to an NA meeting? And I said, NA meant nurse's aid. So I said, no, I just went straight to RN. And she said, keep coming back. Well, my third or fourth time at that rehab, when I walked in, the secretary at the door, she said, honey, this isn't what we meant by keep coming back. I do like to call it the rehab tour of the tri-state area up there, Pittsburgh, West Virginia, Ohio, kind of went to everyone up there at least once. And, you know, I used to be able to tell you I've been to this many detoxes, this many rehabs, and I've long since forgotten, lost count. I have no idea. And, you know, in 94, and I used it as an excuse then. I didn't realize that's what I was doing, but I just couldn't handle it. I'd been clean and sober for 3 years because I was being monitored by the nursing board, frankly. And I was a GSR in my home group, and I sponsored people. Everything was up here, and there was nothing here. And, you know, I'm real good with books. You know, I can read all that stuff, and I can look good and sound good, and that's what I did. And I found my mother dead one morning, and first thing I did was I ate a couple of her morphine pills, and it was on, and that was it. And, you know, my sister came and, you know, asked me if I wanted to split a bag of heroin with her and have a drink, and I said, great idea. And that was it. I left my children. I left them with their father. And thank God for him, because if it hadn't been for him, my children would have ended up in foster care. And I have nothing bad to say about the man. He did a very good job, and he raised my children. And, you know, to this day, that's something that's really hard for me. But I came to Florida in 98 to straighten myself up. I was going to do that at Bike Week in Daytona. But Long Island iced teas were my breakfast. Figured it was tea. You always have tea for breakfast. So I had Long Island iced teas were my breakfast every day. And I still had the whole mindset, as long as I didn't touch that other stuff. I drank every single day and got into just as much trouble. And then I would always go start doing the other stuff too. But the drinking was always there. Always. And I just recently remembered that I used to wake up in the middle of the night and have to have vodka. I'd have to have a couple swigs of vodka before I could go back to sleep. And that was years ago, and I mean, I'm just remembering some of this stuff. But anyway, when I left here with three felony warrants, and I went back to Pennsylvania, I didn't go back to Pittsburgh, I went to Reading across the state on the other side and wreaked havoc there. You know, it took Florida 6 years, but I always like to thank the Hillsborough County Sheriffs because they brought me here in their free relocation program. You know, I thought I was at least going to get a plane ride or something, but they shackled me and stuck me on a bus for 5 days. And that is what you call pitiful. And oh my goodness, why can't I remember? Because I love that phrase. There you go. And that's my favorite, because that's what that was. I mean, that was how much lower could I think? And I had, believe me, I sunk pretty low. And, you know, I don't need to go into details. We all know it. I did a lot of things I'm not proud of. A lot of things like that. I lived in this circle of guilt where, you know, I would do these things and I would have to get drunk to get over the guilt. Then I would have to drink more because I was guilty for drinking. And when I say drinking, I just mean everything. So I'm just going to say drinking because we're in an AA meeting, but I wasn't particular. I know. So that's how much, I mean, that's how I lived most of my life. And after my mom died, I just kind of went off. And it was just, like I said, I left my children. I left everything. And I moved across the state and came here, of course, for those few months. But when they came and got me, and they shackled me and put me on a bus for 5 days, and I will never forget that. I can still bring it back with sufficient, you know, I can still feel it. 5 days being shackled on a bus and not being able to bathe or brush my teeth. And to top it off, each one of my charges carried a 3 to 15 year sentence, and I had three of them. And there was a guard on the bus that I know today that I'll bet that he's in some kind of 12-step fellowship somewhere. But he said to me, "How many times do you want to do this? How many times do you want to, you know, keep starting over?" Because I had been to so many detoxes, and, you know, I even started visiting the mental wards because they would stop letting me in the detoxes. So I just say, "I'm going to kill myself." So I needed a break, you know, so I started going to mental wards. And I was on depression medication for years because I was clinically depressed, and, you know. So anyway, I get to, you know how they do here. I don't know why they do this in Florida, but they let you out of jail at like 2 a.m. Like, they tell you at 7 a.m. that you're free to go, and then, but not until like 2 the next morning. And they lost my purse. So I'm dressed for April in Pittsburgh, and it's now the end of May in Florida. So I wasn't even appropriately dressed. And all I had was the phone of a girl that was in a cell with me. And she's not in the fellowship. She's not one of us. She's just a very nice lady. And she's one of my very best friends still today. But she took me home, and they outfitted me and ran in a bath. And I weighed probably 88 pounds soaking wet. And she had a lot of drama going on in her life too, and she had a lot of kids and stuff like that. So, and I heard about Metropolitan Ministries from a guy that was standing outside the jail when I got out at 2 a.m. And I went there, and there was a waiting list. So I went to the Salvation Army, the shelter down on Florida Avenue. And here, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I was an RN. And I was working in a shrimp factory for $5 an hour. And I still had a little bit of the guns to prove it. They're still there. I was throwing around 50-pound boxes of frozen shrimp every day. And I went to a meeting or church every single day. And I was just, I can't take credit for it. I can't. You know, they thought I was Mother Teresa or something down there. Because, I mean, it was just all right there, the booze and, you know, everything else, and it was all right there, and I had no desire. I wanted to change, and every other day I'd say I'm going back to Pittsburgh, that I don't have to do any drugs. I could just sell them. And somebody said monkeys can't sell bananas. And I already knew that. But it was, you know, one night I didn't have the $10 because there was no work. And this guy that slept outside told me, "Don't worry, honey," he said, "I'm going to go get you a clean piece of cardboard and we'll take turns watching you so you're safe all night." Oh, great. You know, and I went to a meeting that day, and I was just crying. I was just, I'm going to sleep outside on a clean piece of cardboard tonight. And this lady that I've never seen before and haven't seen since came up to me and gave me the $10. And she said, "You know, go inside." And every day I would go to Metropolitan Ministries to see if my room was ready. And somebody please tell me when I'm getting close, okay? Because I have no senses. I'll talk for like 2 hours. You know? Just leave. But, where was I? Oh, you know, I would go there every day and ask. And I remember the guy, George, was his name. And every day I'd say, "Is my room, is there a room open yet?" And he'd say, "Oh, no, go get you a donut and sit down." Oh, gosh. And it was every day I'd say, "That's it, I'm going back to Pittsburgh." But I just kept one more day in it. Somebody would talk to me from either that church or one of the meetings, and they would say, "Just one more day. Just give it one more day." And I kept on one more day in it, because I knew, finally, that the doing the same thing was going to get me the same results. I knew that if I went back, that I was going to start doing the same thing that I'd been doing my whole life. And I didn't know a soul here. I didn't. And, you know, the first meeting they took me to, I'm not even going to mention the name because it won't be nice, because it was not a good experience. And I tell you this to tell you something else. You never know when your meeting is going to be someone's first impression. Because I walked in there, and at that point, I probably looked exactly like what I was. Homeless, half dead, and you know, I had no makeup on, and you know, I was tiny, and you know, probably looked emaciated. But I remember I promised my counselor that I would raise my hand and I would say, "I'm new here." So, and I did. And it took everything I had in me to do that. And I said, "I don't know anybody here and I need help." And not one woman approached me. We came out of the meeting and the guys went to the guys from the ministries, but the women walked right by me. And that stuck with me. And I thought, well, if this is AA, you know, I don't want anything to do with it. But that the next meeting they took me to was at 3333, and those women, like, swarmed on me. And, you know, the next time I came to a meeting, they'd all got together and got me clothes and makeup and perfume and just girl stuff. And it was just awesome. I'm living in this little room with three other people. And, you know, like, you couldn't actually even have two people standing up in there at the same time. If you wanted to get in, you had to ask whoever was up to come out so you can get in. You know, and I lived like that. And it worked since, mainly that's like a self-sufficiency program where people would go there and would go to a technical school or something. I already had a degree and everything. I had no idea what I was going to do. And they put me to work in the outreach department because I had some skills. And I met one of the volunteers there that it helped me to relearn how to do life. I had to suit up and show up every day. I had to be on time. I had to dress properly. And I had to, you know, and believe it or not, I'd done that for years, you know, prior to this. But by the time they got a hold of me, I had been I can't even say I was a ghetto nerd. You know, that was like way above me. I did a lot of things that I, you know, still think about today. And they taught me. They retaught me. That suit up and show up no matter how you feel, which is another reason why I am here tonight. You know, I've never said no when somebody's asked me to speak, because there's been so many times that I've heard somebody say things that has just saved me for the day. and you never know when you're going to say something that somebody needs to hear. And, you know, life kept showing up for me, and it wasn't easy, but I met so many people that just blew my mind. They took care of me. Like, I met this family from New York that just, like, adopted me. They're my family in Tampa. And I actually moved in with them. He got me a job at H&R Block, and I moved in with him, and I remember being at a meeting, and I said, I was scared, because I had to go to work the next day. And I said, if I go, they're going to expect me to come back the next day, like at the same time. And they all laughed, and I was serious. I hadn't done that in so long that just the thought of it scared the hell out of me. You know, but I did it. I went, and then I went back the next day, and I went back every day. And I actually moved in with that family, and I met so many people at 3333. That was the only place I would go for a long time, because I was just so uncomfortable in my own skin that if you would have told me that I'd be standing here today, you know, talking in front, I'd have never believed it. I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. But I would go to those meetings, and people would say the most bizarre stuff that I'd been thinking my whole life, but would never say out loud. And they would just, like, say it, and, you know, not care. So I thought, wow, this is great, you know? So I started talking about all that bizarre crap that had been in my head my whole life. And it was amazing that, you know, nobody batted an eye. And I remember my counselor at the ministry, like, I told him, I need antidepressants. I'm clinically depressed. He said, I'd be depressed too if I were you. He said, you're just extradited, you know, thousands of miles from your home. Your family won't talk to you. Your kids won't talk to you. You have no one, nothing. You're an alcoholic and a drug addict. I'd be depressed too. He says, you go to a meeting every day. You get a sponsor. You work the steps. He says, you come back in 6 months, and if you're still depressed, I'll take you to a psychiatrist myself. And I can tell you what, it didn't even take 1 month before I decided that I wasn't depressed. I just needed to get honest. I just needed to get all that stuff out of me. And I needed to fill that hole that I didn't know needed to be filled with God and not all that other stuff. And that's what you people taught me here. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's going on today. I'm not going to talk too much, because I guarantee I've been crazy, and I will probably cry, and because I just do for the heck of it. Because I worked at Metropolitan Ministries. I ended up getting a job there, and I never left there. I was like the resident that never left. I moved out, and then, you know, I volunteered, and they gave me a job as a receptionist, and then they found out that I could write. So I got promoted to a development assistant, and I would interview the residents and write stories in there, in our their appeals that they send out. And we had talked about getting my RN back, like, maybe 5 years ago, and I talked about it, but I was afraid. I didn't think I could do that. But then I found out that I had this passion when I'd be down in outreach, when people would come in, and they'd come in for the 100th time, and the other people would be in there, he's a bum, he's just a drunk, and I would think, no, he's sick, he needs help. And I would get so passionate about it, and I said, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. So they started letting me do, on Fridays, I actually worked in the programs department, and I would do relapse prevention classes, and I would have groups with the residents, and I actually would take them to meetings sometimes at night when we could get them to go, but, you know, things were different then. But they said that they were going to expand and get the recovery program back, but they wanted to have a person with a CAP, a certified addictions professional, and they needed a bachelor's in psychology in order to get that. So I went back to school, and I'm three classes away from a bachelor's in psychology. I ended up losing my job because of a decrease in the workforce. The day after, I financed a car. And this all, everybody talks about the 50-year horror stories or 50-year sobriety. This all happened the week I was celebrating my 5th year of sobriety. I financed a car, and I was just so proud that somebody would finance me with my horrible credit. And I was just so proud. Like 19 hours later, I lost my job. And I went back and tried to give the car back. And I remember telling the HR lady, I said, yeah, the job doesn't concern me because, if you know, God's closing this door, apparently there's another one to open. The car, I wasn't so sure about. Because I self-willed that. I just wanted to buy myself a car. So I was really scared about that. And I went back and a guy told me, I don't care if your grandma died. We're not even going to talk about that. That was wrong. That car's gone, by the way. I got an automotive demotion. But, you know, that whole, you know, right within a couple of weeks, I lost my job, bought the car, I left a year-long relationship and got my own apartment. So I'd like depleted my savings account for a down payment for a car and an apartment, and then lost my job. And then my brother's brain swelled up in Pittsburgh for no reason. Does that mean I've been talking for 15 minutes or I have 50 minutes left? 50 minutes left? Oh, we could tell you a lot in 15 minutes. Yeah, that's cool. You can rate me at the end, everybody put up 9. Yeah. The bottom line to all that was, I didn't have to drink or do anything else. I called all my people, and I hung close to them, and, you know, I managed to get my RN renewed. I had to reactivate it in Pennsylvania. They made me retake the state boards, and I'm still in college, mind you, and I'm 48 years old, and I fried quite a few brain cells. I was wondering how this was going to work out. But I did it. I have an active RN license in Florida and Pennsylvania. The first job interview I went around was at ACTS, and they hired me. And then DCF said no. Because of my... And, you know, they put me through a lot of stuff. I had to get them all my court records. I had to actually fly back to Pennsylvania a couple times. And it was a lot of money and... A lot. It was a lot. And but I have them. I'm licensed in Pennsylvania and Florida, and I'm still unemployed because of DCF. And my nursing experience is so old that the hospitals aren't, like, jumping all over themselves to hire me. But I got offered a job at Fairwinds the next day. And so right now I'm in the middle of doing everything that I had done for the nursing boards for DCF. This is why, I told you it's going to be your fault. But they're putting me through it, basically. And the lady at DCF can told me to give up the other day. And I told her no. She said, you won't be able to get a job anyway. I said, I had a job. You know, as I was offered 2 jobs, actually. You know, I'm uniquely qualified to work in a substance abuse facility. Because I remember when I was in them, anybody would come to me, especially if I was in acute withdrawal, and tell me it wasn't that bad, and then tell me they weren't an alcoholic or an addict. You know, that was kind of like how I felt when my husband was telling me it wasn't that bad when I was in labor. You know, you don't have a clue. You don't have a clue what it's like to have to do something, even when you don't want to do it. You know, I can remember not wanting to drink, actually crying, or not wanting, you know, to do other things, and actually crying because I didn't want to do it, and not able to stop myself. You can't know what that's like if you haven't gone through it. Because, you know, in my 2 younger sons had never quite stopped talking to me, but they were kind of, you know, ambivalent about me, I suppose. I don't know. But my oldest son would not speak to me at all. Even when I went home and everybody else in the family would tell him, she's okay now, you know, she means it this time. You know, he'd heard it so much. And, you know, he's 29 now. But I'm just, a year ago, and I used to stalk him, like, you know, just on birthdays and holidays and stuff. I just kind of stalk him a little bit. And last year on his birthday, when I called him, he actually called me back. He returned the call. So I have all three of my sons back in my life, and they're grown men now. You know, my youngest is 21, and he was basically raised by my aunt. Because he was only 6 when I decided to just take off. And I mean, I would roll in and out of their life. And I remember my oldest son at about maybe 15, 16 years old telling me, don't call. He said, because every time the phone rings, I think it's somebody calling to say you're dead in a ditch. Everybody's always dead in a ditch, I don't know, but that you're dead in a ditch. So, you know, if you don't call, that's one less phone call we're going to get. And that's a hell of a thing for a young man to be carrying around. You know, to this day, I don't know, you know, the kind of pain I caused my sons. I know that I blamed my parents for a long time for the way I grew up. Because it was like, I mean, we had going away to jail parties when I was young for people. I remember getting sent to get a cake. I always tell this story because it's hilarious. Because my mom told me to go get a cake and tell them to write something on it. Because the guy was going to jail for 10 years. I was like, what, Mom, you know? See you in 10 years? Or and he started, don't drop the soap. And he, sucks to be you. You know, everybody's coming up all these things. That was my childhood. You know? Then you wonder why I'm here. Yeah, that explains a lot, doesn't it? But, you know, that's pretty much how I grew up, and that was normal. And alcohol is just, like I said, it was on the grocery list. It was just a normal part of the household, and that's what everybody did, and that's what we all did. And, you know, except my husband, it's like I kind of married him, but he was one of those freaks that would get a beer and it would last like 3 hours. I want to go home before there was still beer in the keg. Seriously, dude. But thank God I did, because he was a good father to my sons. And, you know, I got right, my another thing that made a big difference is my friend Bob Kelly said to me, and no one had ever told me this, I can't remember what I said to him, but he said to me, you don't have a drinking problem, you have a living problem. And it was the first time that it occurred to me that I just didn't know how to live. And I used alcohol just to get me through the day, because that's how it got. At the end, it just got me right. I didn't get drunk or anything. I just got so that I could do the day. And that was it. I didn't know how to live. And you know, and I met a lot of people that we just kind of stuck close with. And Heather was my first sponsee. And at 9 months, I started sponsoring her. And a month prior to that, I still know this girl today, and we laugh about it, but she asked me to sponsor her. And I said, oh, hell no, I'm crazy. And I was afraid that I was going to make her crazy. You probably won't get drunk, but you'll be crazy. And so I said no. And I remember my sponsor bit my head off. So she said no? So I said, to this day, I don't know how Heather's still sober, because I was so crazy. But that's what it's about, you know. I did with her what was done with me. I didn't say no when people asked me to sponsor them. I got into it right away. I got a home group. And I still today, most of my friends are in recovery. 99% of them are in mostly AA, but I have some in the other fellowship. Let's put this, everybody I know is trying to live a spiritual life and you know, and seeking God. And, you know, I've been having some issues lately because of all the stuff that's just been happening to me. It's been like one thing after another. And but I'm still here. And I can tell you that I was more concerned about, you know, going crazy than I was about getting drunk. And that's because of how I've been living the past 6.5 years. The first thought that comes to my mind isn't to just go drown this and go cover it up. You know, I talk about it and I talk to people, and I don't like crying. I swear I didn't cry for like 15 years. I cried more the past couple months than I think I probably cried my whole life. And like I said, it could be for no particular reason. I killed a Chihuahua dog and I had nightmares for like a week, and I cried and cried and cried. And it's just, I'm a completely different person. I've had that complete psychic change that the book talks about. And even the first time my brother saw me, when I went back home, he told me that I didn't even look the same. I don't talk the same, I don't walk the same, I don't look the same. I'm a completely different person. And my first thought today isn't to try to medicate whatever's going on. And believe me, life keeps happening. It's been, you know, up and down and up and down, and it hasn't always been easy. And it's been, I know that getting drunk is not going to help anything right now. It is not, you know, I've learned that here, that there's so many other ways to do it. I'm like, and this is probably, I'm going to leave here tonight, and I know that when I leave here tonight, I'm going to feel better, even though I didn't want to do it. And that was another thing I learned here. Sometimes you got to do shit you don't want to do. That's what grown-ups do. For some, you know, I stayed a child my whole life. If I didn't want to do it, I didn't do it. It's not like that today. And I try to live like a grown-up. I'm pretty good at it 80% of the time. But I try to do everything it says to do in the book. You know, I don't do it perfectly 100% of the time. I don't. And lately, it's been more difficult than it ever has been since I came to Florida. But I'm not quitting. When she told me to hang it up at DCF, I told her no. And I'm not. I believe that that's what I'm meant to do, is to show people that no matter how far down you've gone, or you think you're hopeless or worthless like I did, I really truly thought there was no hope for me. That is not true. As long as you got a breath in your body, there's hope for you. And I know when I leave here tonight, I'm going to feel better, and I won't say no even if Dick does break up with me. There's always other girlfriends are here tonight anyway. But I want to thank you for asking me, because it's probably just what God had in mind for me right now. And I love all of you, and I do love AA, and thank you for asking me to speak in it.